Welcome to Let's Dialogue. Today we're broadcasting from the Sun Valley, Idaho, in the beautiful Elkhorn Resort here, where we're holding our annual Saints Alive Conference. We call it the Capstone Conference. Today I have as my interview guests for you Dennis and Rowney Higley, who are from Vernal, Utah. And it just happens that the Higleys have been involved in recent months in one of the more wonderful phenomena that we have encountered in our time working with Saints Alive, and that is in the little town of Vernal, Utah, which is on the eastern central side of the state up in a beautiful vacation country. There has been a revival of just, I don't know if we can call it a revival, but yes, that too, but people are coming alive in Jesus Christ, people who've never known the reality of the personal relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ have suddenly found out that there is a possibility to really know in a personal way the creator of the universe. Today, I would just like to kick things off by asking Dennis. Dennis, if it wasn't for your little beard, I would almost expect you to you look kind of like a bishop or something. You really have a, you know, just neat little wrinkles around your eyes from your smiling and grinning. And would you just kind of give me a little background on your life as to where you grew up, what is your background in the religious area, and something to that point. And so I'm just going to kick it over to you and let you kind of share with me for a few minutes here.
Okay, I'm originally born and raised in the Rupert Burley area of Idaho. I was a fourth generation Mormon, my parents both being very active in the Mormon Church. My father served for over 11 years as a ward clerk in the ward that I grew up in. My mother was active in the Primary and the Relief Society, MIA, and so as children we were raised in a very Mormon household, taught the Mormon gospel, and were very active in it. At age 12, I was ordained a deacon, age 14, a teacher, age 16, a priest, and age 19, an elder, and 21 days after I was ordained an elder, I was serving on a mission in Finland. I served 2.5 years there. Came back and served in different positions in the church, and in 1968, I guess it would be, the Valley View 6th Ward in Salt Lake City, I was called to serve as Elders Quorum President, and a couple of years later, we moved to Vernal. I was back in the Elders Quorum Presidency again, and overall, between 1968 and 1978, which is a 10-year period, I served as Elders Quorum Secretary, Counselor, and President. Mm-hmm. And in 1978, I was called to serve on the Mazur Stake High Council, and I served there for 3.5 years, and that's where we were, or I was, when we came out of the Mormon Church.
Okay, and I noticed you said that you were on mission 2.5 years. Now, that sounds a little unusual to me, because I'm used to expecting missionaries to go on the field for 2 years. Evidently, you were pretty enthusiastic, weren't you?
Well, back at that time period when I was called to serve on a mission, they didn't have the language training center at BYU like they do now, where they teach the prospective missionaries how to speak the language. We had to go to the country and learn the language there. Mm-hmm. And so they figured that at that time it'd take about 6 months to where an elder could learn the language sufficiently well that he could carry on a conversation and converse with the people of that country and start to expound the Mormon Mormon religion.
Yes, I see. Well, now, since I don't want to get so far ahead that we can't come back and begin to put some pieces together on the other side of the family here, so I'm going to swing over to Rowney. Rowney, that name is, I wouldn't consider it to be a classic Scotch-Irish or English or even a German name. Would you kind of explain what your background is, and why don't you give me a little information there for the radio, for our radio audience, just telling about your background.
Yes, my name is Rowney, and that is a Finnish, that's a very typical Finnish name. It's not a common Finnish name, but it is strictly Finnish. I was born and raised in Finland. I grew up in a country that was 93% Lutheran. Mm. I was a Lutheran until I joined the Mormon Church. I also became a very zealous Mormon after I joined the Mormon Church 7 months after my joining the Mormon Church, I was interviewed by the mission president because my great desire to learn about Mormonism, he felt that I was already ready to serve a mission. Now, normally, the year is the minimum that you have to be a member a year so that in order that you can go to the temple. Now, 9 months after I had joined the Mormon Church, I already was on a mission field in Finland serving as a missionary. I had to wait till my year was up before I could go to the Mormon temple.
Is that interesting?
Yes, and I did go to the Switzerland, then with the whole Finnish mission field, went to Swiss Temple. That was one of the last times. They used to do that almost annual basis, that all the missionaries from Finland were flown to Switzerland once a year to do the temple work for a week. But that was the last time, because then the Mormon General Authorities decided that if the plane went down, it would be a difficult situation to train the missionaries to Finland if they lost all 120 missionaries at the same crash, and including the mission president.
I see.
So, but that time we did go to Switzerland and did the temple work, and that's when I received my own endowments in Swiss Temple.
Mm-hmm. Now, it begins to take shape in my mind that somehow between Dennis's mission and you being a Mormon in Finland, you two somehow ran across each other. Now, I used to think that maybe Dennis converted you, but you were not.
No.
Not so.
No. I was already a Mormon, just only a few months old Mormon. When I first time met Dennis, Dennis came to my hometown as a missionary, and then we got to know each other there. Of course, Mormon missionaries are not supposed to date mm-hmm. anybody or have any that kind of relationship, and I knew that very well myself, so we just developed a friendship. We were good friends, and then when I was called on a mission, we served in three separate cities at the same time, which was unusual. I throughout my mission and throughout Dennis's mission, we have compared notes, and we haven't had any other person that happened to be in the same city twice that we would have been in two separate cities, I should mm-hmm. say. Of course, then we thought it was the Mormon God that was directing us together, you know, and that was yes. our fate, you know, as the Mormons. But now I see that it was the real God, the Creator God, Jehovah, who was actually leading us. He knew He had already called us by name.
Yes.
He was preparing us to serve the ministry for Him after we learn all about the Mormonism.
Isn't that marvelous, Dennis? Now, things were shaping up in your mind, obviously, here. You're going to become a God. You're all worthy Mormon, and you found your lady. What kind of things were going through your mind as far as now you're this little Finnish gal, and I suspect you thinking, well, I'm going to take her back to Utah with me. Kind of go through a little of that for me here now.
Well, as the mission rules go, you weren't supposed to communicate in any way with any of the local Finnish sisters, but Rowney and I did write to each other even while we were in Finland as missionaries. See, after she was called on a mission, missionaries could write to each other. So we communicated quite often, just writing letters to each other. And in September of 65, Rowney had already previously to that applied for a visa to come to the U.S. So in September she came to the U.S. and I was still in Finland. So that made it even more logical to communicate, which we did. We wrote on a regular basis then because she was in the U.S. and I was still in Finland. And I returned from Finland in November of 65. And, of course, we'd had already almost a two-year relationship mm-hmm. as friends and couldn't really count it a courtship. But we dated for a while, and then we got married.
Okay. Now, you're still Mormons.
At that time, yes, we were still Mormons. We were married in the Salt Lake Temple.
Uh-huh.
In December of 65.
December 65. And I'm going to swing over to Rowney again. Now, Rowney, something began to occur in your life, because here you are now, a Finnish lady, in the United States. You speak the language, and you are what we would call, I guess, if our listeners will forgive the expression, you're kind of Molly Mormon. You're really turned on. You're doing everything that you know to do as a good, worthy Mormon. And can you give us now, let's just pick up and move right along on what begins to happen in your life in the United States now, relating to the Mormon Church?
Yes, as soon as I arrived at Salt Lake City, of course I didn't personally know anybody except some of the missionaries that I had met during my mission and while I was a new convert to the church, but other Mormons I didn't know. Of course, the first thing I needed was a job, and
just cut right there. Okay, I'm going to turn back to Ronnie now for a second, because Ronnie, you're now in the United States, and you're a young Finnish lady, and of course you're, as we might say, and asking the forbearance of those who might think this is an offensive expression. You were Miss Molly Mormon. And you'd come to the United States now, very enthusiastic young Mormon woman. And what's the next thing that began to happen in your life?
Yes, number one thing maybe I should mention why I wanted to come to Utah. I had applied for my visa 2 years before I left Finland. It took 2 years to get the visa. And so that was long before I even met Dennis at all. I had applied to come to the United States. My reason wasn't really to stay, but I wanted to come to see what the Zion was like. Mm-hmm. And I yearned to converse with the Mormons that were born into the Church Mormons, who could discuss the doctrine of the Mormonism with me. I have found that there was very few books available in Finnish in Finland. There was no books about Mormonism in English either. So I didn't really, I just yearned that knowledge to know all about the new truth I had found. And so Finnish people that were converts to the Mormon Church, of course, they didn't really know that much about the Mormon doctrine. They believed it, but they didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
So I was so anxious to come to the States and to be able to converse with these people that have grown up in the Mormon Church, that could answer all my questions and would be so willing to discuss this doctrine with me. So I began to find out very shortly that kind of people were not around. The Utah Mormons were not knowledgeable about the Mormon doctrine. They did not want to discuss it with me. There was, I was just absolutely appalled, the lack of their knowledge of the Mormon doctrine.
Right.
I thought, anyway, now here I am in Salt Lake City. At least I have all the books available.
Yes.
And so I'm going to hit the books. But before I got too far in that, of course, I needed to get a job. I had sold everything I owned to serve the mission, mm-hmm. because I didn't have the parents alive to support my mission, so I had to do it on my own. So I sold everything I had, and I was really low on funds at the time, because I came to Salt Lake City right after my mission. So I had to get a job, and I put a few job applications around town, and then I went to the church office building, and I talked to a couple of departments, and they said that the jobs that they had in the other departments would have been too boring or too didn't require too much skill. They were more or less secretarial work or the filing type of thing. And then I remember his name was Brother Christensen. I don't know his first name. He worked at the membership department. He told me that the church had just barely opened the translation services department.
Mm-hmm.
And the director of that was at the time Thomas Fiennes, who now is a general authority at the Mormon Church. And he sent me to talk to Thomas Pius. He said, since I had taught school in Finland, I had done creative writing, I had done things that this Christensen Bud would be really a qualification. And of course, I thought, well, this was again directed by God, that I had had an interest on these fields in my mm-hmm. life prior to becoming a Mormon. So I was really excited about that possibility. I went and filled a job application at the translation department. They gave me the test, the translation test.
Yes.
And then it was checked, sent for checking of the accuracy and also of the my creative writing ability, because translation is not just knowing the words in Finnish and in English, but it is the ability to put it
you have to bring the understanding across, don't you?
Right, and not only that, but you have to be able to be creative in so that it sounds, it's easy to read, it's good to, goes really fluently.
You almost say you have to rewrite the whole thing in your idiom, in
right.
your way of thinking.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yes, you know, it is not just translating words,
yes.
like looking up from a dictionary. Uh-huh. You do have to have an ability to write
right.
it down so that it is good.
Right. Now, what did this lead you to?
Well, that led me to work and study, the study became my full-time job. Because in order to translate the material that was to be translated, it was books and manuals, books for the priesthood classes, for Sunday school classes, for Relief Society, for Primary, for Mutual, that is the youth organization. All the literature that was to be, because the Mormon Church was at that time coordinating the worldwide effort to teach the same exact material worldwide.
The unified lesson approach, right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And everything, all the same material, same lesson material, same priesthood material, was to be sent to all countries
mm-hmm.
so that the Mormons throughout the world were learning the same thing
right.
at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were actually working ahead of schedule, preparing material for the following year.
Yes.
But a lot of the quotes came from the old Mormon books, from Journal Discourses,
right.
from the History of the Church, and that led me into studying those books because I had to check the quotes in context in order that I knew that I was getting a right idea.
Yes.
That I wouldn't quote something, that I wouldn't misunderstand the quote.
So we can say that you needed to be, your thinking and your communication needed to be thoroughly Mormon at this point, so
yes.
you wouldn't convey a wrong thought.
Right. And then also that I would not convey the thought that wasn't meant to be there, that I wouldn't
That's
quote
right.
the Mormon
Good.
Leaders out of context, even though the quote was there already in the English material, but I needed to read it in context so that I would understand the full meaning before and after, so that it would be absolutely accurate.
Yeah.
So that led me into knowing. So that was exactly what I was after when I came to Salt Lake City.
Perfect, huh?
It was perfect. And I was really thinking that, you know, that boosted my testimony of the Mormon Church. Because
Obviously.
I thought, well, this is really exactly where the Mormon God is leading me to. Of course, I was thinking
yes.
of the terms of the God, because mm-hmm. I was under the impression that the Mormon God was the God of the Bible.
Yes.
And so I was elated with this whole process, and so I was very eagerly studying, and not only reading those quotes or the paragraphs or the chapters, but I went into studying the books and books
oh,
after
right.
books after books.
Oh,
you know.
Great! Now something happened. You began to translate, as I recall you telling me, the temple ritual.
Yes, it was in the 1970 that the film, now the Mormon Church was sending the same film for the endowment ceremony,
mm-hmm.
endowment part of the ceremony, to all temples. That was part of this unified system,
right.
Teaching system, and then the same film was going to be in all temples worldwide.
All right, Ronnie, during this time now that you're in this new job and you're studying and you're getting all these wonderful things that you've been wanting to all your life, an event takes place which begins to change the whole scene for you. And I'd like to have you just now go right into what began to transpire at this point in your life.
I had been now translating since 1965 for the church. It was 1970 when the church decided to send the same film, temple, about the temple endowment, to each temple worldwide. Now that film and the ceremony and the, all the other ordinances as well needed to be translated into those languages that they had temples for.
Mm-hmm.
So I received the assignment to go to Salt Lake Temple and start translating the temple ceremony into Finnish language. Well, I would have to say here that I had found that even during these five-year periods, there were periods in my life that that statements, that the doctrines hit rather strange from the Mormon. They like jumped out from the Mormon book pages, and I had started to see some things that they didn't really quite add up. But when that kind of thoughts came to my mind, I quickly turned them off because I told myself, I am not supposed to doubt. I am mm-hmm. not supposed to question.
Yes.
I will learn, I will learn someday that all these will fit perfectly into the picture.
It's amazing. And now you were actually violating your own conscience at that point, weren't you?
Yes, well, I didn't think it that way. I just thought it was the devil himself who was trying to show me some errors in the Mormonism, and that that I thought were errors, but actually were not, that they would somehow fit there, and someday I will see the answer.
The better understanding,
yeah. Right, and so I went, that was the one reason why I wanted to study more and more and more,
mm-hmm.
so that that error would be eliminated, the doubts would totally go away, and that I would gain this perfect testimony of the Mormon gospel rather than having these nagging doubts and questions.
Uh-huh.
Why did Brigham Young say Adam was God when he, you know, when we don't believe it today, or, you know, blood atonement, or, you know, when we
yes.
don't believe it today? And there were things that jumped from the pages
yes.
to me that if that man was a prophet then, he should be, you know, he's
still credible today, yes.
Right.
So.
His teaching should be still upheld today, because
right.
Often I was told, you know, that comparing New Testament and Old Testament, how the things have changed, but that is not comparable, because the Christ came to fulfill the law, and so I quite couldn't fit those explanations
mm-hmm.
in my mind. But anyway, go back to the temple ceremony. I started to, I had of course been a temple Mormon. I had done a lot of temple work. Dennis and I, we both together did genealogy and temple work for my dead relatives, and we were very faithful temple goers.
Mm-hmm.
We quite often went early morning, like 5 o'clock in the morning session, to Salt Lake Temple, and we did that, you know, sometimes several times a week, and we had done over 200 endowments for my own relatives alone from a family file that I had done the research myself.
Uh-huh.
So, we were faithful temple goers. So I did know the ceremony. I had heard the ceremony.
Yes.
And that is totally different, you know, and that is a unique experience even as a Mormon. There are not very many except the temple workers, and even today's temple workers do not all of them have the text in front of them. Maybe the part that they're playing live sessions in Salt Lake Temple, but now with the films, that people that work in the temple, they don't need to know the temple ceremony, so they don't need to memorize it anymore like they used to.
Yes.
So it is a very rare. You can really see how very few people there are today that have ever seen the temple ceremony In writing, yes. In front of them.
I don't know of anyone I've ever spoken to that has actually seen it except you.
Right, and you know, at the time that I started to translate the temple ceremony, Brother Sorensen from the temple presidency from Salt Lake Temple, he told me that the 5 points of fellowship, the veil part, going through the veil part, health and the navel, marrow and the bones,
yes.
Strength and alignment, and etc. That part had never been in writing, even in Salt Lake Temple. It had always been passed on as a, because they held it that was so sacred that they couldn't write that down. To my big amazement, later on I found out that it was written down in all the Masons' books, you know, so it wasn't anything that quite sacred. I could have read it from there. But anyway, I was given the full ceremony, starting from the baptismal service, from washing anointings, from, you know, every single word that is used and said in a temple, everything in one book. That was a very, very secret thing. We had to go to the fifth floor of the Salt Lake Temple in a Talmage room.
Last time I've heard of that room.
Right, where James Talmage wrote the book Jesus the Christ and Articles of Faith. That is the room where I translated the temple ceremony. Now, when I had that ceremony in front of me, I had all the time that I needed to use to get it in an accurate, correct language, in the understanding and meaning, everything exactly right. We were told to take all the time you need.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing is that you get it exactly and accurately as
yeah.
It is. And so that started me in a totally different trend of thought, because rather than being rushed through the ceremony like you are when you're doing endowment ceremonies for the dead, now I had time to ponder and think about the words, think about the meaning behind them. Who was giving orders in the temple ceremony? Who was doing what and where and when? And I realized that this ceremony was not from God. It was Lucifer himself who was playing the main role. He was giving the orders. I started to pay attention to the apron.
Mm-hmm.
That in a Salt Lake, I used to go quite often while I was translating the ceremony to do the endowment ceremony myself for the dead, so that I could really apply it into my finished translation.
Mm-hmm.
And I often tried to get a seat right in the front row so that I could see everything as it was happening in a live session in
yes.
Salt Lake Temple, where they had live actors. And that's when I began to notice and pay attention to the apron that Satan was wearing in a temple
mm-hmm.
ceremony.
I'd like to have you take just a moment to describe that apron as you can recall it, Ronnie, before we go on here.
Yes, that apron is a dark blue. When the temple patrons, as it's a temple, you know, people going through the ceremony are wearing green aprons.
Yes.
But Lucifer wears a dark blue apron that has black embroidery signs embroidered on it. He wears a black suit in a Salt Lake Temple, and that suit is buttoned up, so you only see the hem of that apron at first. But then Adam comes to Lucifer and asks him, "What is this apron that you have on?" And Lucifer answers, "This is an emblem of my power and my priesthood." And then he opens the coat, the jacket,
uh-huh.
and flashes that apron. He does it really quickly, but you can see, and I began, pardon me, I began to look at the sign. Each time I focused on the different parts of that apron so that I could get a full picture of it, and I started to see the Masonic signs on it.
Uh-huh.
I saw sun, moon, stars, obelisk. I saw the compass and the square,
mm-hmm.
You know, I started to see all these different things, all seeing eye, the beehive. I started seeing all these things that are in Lucifer's apron.
But these are all known symbols of Mormonism today.
Yes, and what really hit me hard was that compass and the square were in Lucifer's apron, who claimed that this is a power of Satan. He said, this is the power of, you know, my power and my priesthoods. That's Satan's speaking.
Yes.
And then I see the signs that I'm wearing in my garments next to my bare skin.
Yes.
As a priesthood signs to protect me.
Uh-huh.
And that shook me so bad that, you know, I started to think, am I going out of my mind? Am I imagining these things? What's happening? You know, how can Lucifer claim that these signs, this apron that has all these signs on, that they're his signs of his power and his priesthoods? He says in plural, his priesthoods. And that is never refuted in a temple ceremony. That is never questioned, that he has power and priesthoods. And immediately after that, after Lucifer has made that statement, comes the part where we as the temple patrons, temple workers for the dead, are told to put on our fig leaf aprons.
Mm-hmm.
And even though our aprons didn't have those signs on, but we already had them on our garments that we had underneath our clothing.
Incredible.
Incredible, yes, that is true. And I was absolutely in shock. I remember after going through one particular session, I went back to the fifth floor. And there's a room right next to Talmud's room, which is a humongous room where the solemn assemblies are held, where the Mormons, when they have a special prayer time for something like a capstone conference or something like that, they go to pray to their God. When a large group of missionaries are sent on the mission field, they go and receive a special prayer or blessing there on that solemn assembly, great assembly room.
Yes.
That is right next to the Talmud's room. Now, on that room, it's set up like a Masonic hall. The chairs and the pulpits and everything on both ends of the room.
Okay, just like the Masonic Lodge.
Exactly, just like a Masonic Lodge. And but what the point I was hitting is that that was the room where I went to pray. I went to that room where they at the end of the room where they have the stairs and the chairs on a, like in a theater type of setting. They're soft, wonderful, luxurious red chairs, you know, and the red thick carpets and everything. That was a perfect place to pray, because it was comfortable. For one thing, it was comfortable to kneel down there, and then you knew that nobody would be there, because very seldom there was anything going on in that room. So I spent hours and hours and days in prayer in that room, praying and crying that if the Mormonism is true, that the God would answer me in that temple. That he would take away these doubts and the fears and the questions that I had in my mind because of the ceremony and because of the fear that had come to me because I recognized the symbols and the signs of the Satan's apron, and I recognized I was wearing the same signs next to my skin. And I prayed that the God, if he was there, he would answer me. He would speak peace to my heart. He would give me the assurance and take away the fear. He would make me see why this contradiction. But there was no answer. There was just the most recognizable silence.
Just screaming at you.
We have often, Dennis and I, we used to comment that when you go to the temple, you're totally excluded from the world. And there is a silence there that is nowhere. And we thought that was, as a really faithful Mormons, and even at that this time, I was really faithful Mormon. I was just crying out to God to explain it to me. Why? But we always commented about that silence, how But that time when I started to pray, that silence was like screaming at me.
Uh-huh.
That if there was really God in that temple, like I had been told that there was, he would speak to me at that time, not necessarily in audible voice, but he would speak to me, to my heart. He would give me peace. He would not lead me astray, especially when I was in his holy temple,
mm-hmm.
Working for him, doing the temple ceremony so that the Finnish people could understand it the way he would have them understand. But uh-huh. there was no answer.
There was
absolute silence. I was alone. That's when I realized that something terribly wrong is happening. There's something terribly wrong in Mormonism.
Uh-huh.
But I only knew Mormons. I didn't know anybody else. You know, no Christians. I didn't have any contact with anybody else. And I didn't... This was something that I wasn't supposed to talk about outside of the temple.
Mm.
So from there on, I started to seek an opportunity to get Dennis to the temple. Of course, he didn't have the permission to go to where I was.
Obviously.
And, you know, it was very carefully checked who went upstairs. We had to go through the Baptist Department. There were several checkpoints, uh-huh. you know, where your permit was checked, where, you know, we were wearing tags, you know, with our names in the department uh-huh. and so forth. And we had to have a special letter that we had to carry that was from the presiding bishopric that we had a permission to go upstairs. Every translator had that. It's very guarded. Every time you turn a corner, there's someone checking.
So there's utmost security there.
Yes, they're inside of the temple. There's mm-hmm. you can't just wander around.
Obviously.
You're very carefully guided where you're supposed to go, and they come running after you if you go the wrong direction. Obviously, I couldn't take Dennis where I was. I couldn't get him there to discuss the things. But what I was trying to do is to get Dennis to go with me to Provo Temple, the Salt Lake Temple, so that after the ceremony, because during the ceremony, you're separated. You
uh-huh.
can't, and besides, you're told not to talk with anybody. You know, you just have to be absolutely silent. So, what I was waiting each time was that after we get through the veil to the celestial room, that I could then ask Dennis, you know, how he felt about this thing and that thing in a ceremony. But every time we sat down one of the temple workers came and said, well, brother and sister, you do need to move on. You need to leave because there's another citizen coming right behind. We need the room. And so we were always carefully guided away from there. And then as soon as you get away from the celestial room, you are separated again because women have to go to their dressing rooms and men to their dressing rooms, and after that you're out of the temple. So we never really had an opportunity to discuss these things. And that was the most, it took weeks and weeks for me to plan one question and then to try to ask it, because I was that faithful that I would not ask the question outside of the temple from Dennis. Finally, I started saying, pay attention to, like, to Devil's Apron.
Yes.
Before we, you know, when we were walking into the room.
Uh-huh.
Pay attention to that apron. Think about that. And so that way, little by little, we were able to both at least focus,
uh-huh.
you know, but we still didn't discuss these things outside.
Isn't this something now? Obviously, you two have been married by this time, of course.
Yes,
you were.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And so, as husband and wife, you're going through the temple together. Of course, you're getting separated before you went to the washing and anointing rooms, and then they're all the way through until you get to the celestial room. I want to pick up and continue on this, because I think that the next portion of this whole transitional process is the most, I think, the tremendously important part for our radio audience to hear. And it really means that this whole interview is going to extend into an additional week of programming, which is great, because I feel that this whole scenario is of such vital importance to our listeners, particularly in the Intermountain West, that it will be, I believe, a turning point for many, many people. And so we're going to continue this, and we're going to pick up right at this point, Ronnie, and we'll go from there.
Okay.
All right, Ronnie, in talking about these nagging doubts and things that you have discovered as you began to really research the temple, perhaps as very few people from your position have ever done, because you're a convert. You're not somebody that's a fifth-generation Mormon. And there are things that are really, really bothering your mind. You've prayed to the God that you understood there in the assembly hall. I don't know if it's the same as the Holy of Holies, but at least one of these upper rooms in the temple. And God, the God you're calling to, has not answered. And now you begin to bring Dennis into the scene a little bit. Now, he's obviously not asking questions. He's still a faithful Mormon. And in a sense of the word, he's kind of innocent at this point in time. And so I'd like to have you just pick up. You say that you're getting him through the temple now. And you're saying, Dennis, pay attention to thus and thus. And each time you're very careful that you don't obviously violate any rules, because you don't talk about this outside the temple. Now, would you just pick up from that point and let's move right along to this transitional period in your life?
Yes, Dennis and I, we both were very faithful Mormons at that time. I wasn't ready to throw Mormonism out of the window because I had doubts, because I didn't really know which way to turn. I didn't know. I had been so totally brainwashed to think that the Mormonism and the Mormon church is the only true church, that my fear was that if Mormonism ended up being wrong, false doctrine, there was nothing. There was no God. That was my biggest fear. There was no God. See, I had experienced very hard things before I became a Mormon. I lost my parents very early age. My mother when I was 11 and my father when I was 17, and I was the only child. Mm-hmm. And I've been saying little prayers as a child, but not really trained religiously in a biblical doctrine. And when my father died, my grandparents had died, I was absolutely alone in the world, and that's when I quit praying. I told myself there was no God. If there was any, if there was God, he is cruel God, and I don't have anything. Don't want to have anything to do with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so then along came the Mormon missionaries, and they taught me of the different God and the family relation and all this, how I could get all this back. My family back, all my dead relatives, I could become their savior, and we would one day be united. So I had embraced the Mormon gospel for that reason,
mm-hmm.
to get the love, to get the family, to get everything that I had lacked as a young person. Now, when these doubts started to come to my mind that Mormonism wasn't true, I automatically switched to the thing that if Mormonism wasn't true, there wasn't anything.
Mm-hmm.
There was no God. And I thought, where were you Christians? There was nobody. There was nobody reaching out to me. But you know, one thing, that when I started to feed these questions to Dennis, I hit the blank wall. He didn't see any problems in these. Of course, we didn't really discuss these, because those things, I quickly had to slip this question to him when we were walking into the, when we were just barely inside of the temple, when we were jointly walking into the room, just the seconds before we had to go in our separate sides of the room. I whispered a question to him that he was to think. But after we got through, I said, did you think of that? He either just gave me a kind of a blank look. He didn't see anything wrong with it. He didn't see my point, because he had not had a time to ponder. See, the Mormon temple ceremonies is just like you are in a factory,
assembly,
you know,
line.
Assembly line.
Yes.
You're just going through as fast as you can. And you really don't think as a Mormon what is being said. Most people are asleep in a temple ceremony. And that was other thing that bothered me as a Mormon. as a faithful temple-going Mormon. It bothers me because it is even told to the temple patrons, pay attention, be attentive, alert. And we have been told that the dead people can only receive the endowment through us by proxy. And if we are asleep, they don't receive it.
Oh,
so, you know, I was looking at this this temple patron audience there, usually approximately 300 people per session, and most everybody asleep. You know, and I kept thinking, what is it in a Mormon mind that puts them asleep? Why are not Mormons interested in their religion? I was interested in, I have never been a fence sitter. I was a full-force Mormon when I was a Mormon, and because I didn't see any point in being lukewarm. You know, if you believe in something, you endorse it. If you don't, you get out.
That's good.
And so I looked at these, my Mormon brothers and sisters there with, you know, kind of amazement. You know, how could they just sit there and sleep when they had been just told they should be alert? You know, why go through the motions? Doing this temple work if it doesn't do any good if you're asleep. But anyway, but that's how the Mormons are trained in everything. Everything puts them to sleep. Now, that was the thing that bothered me about other people, but then I thought, well, you know, I'm responsible of my doings, not their doings, so I'll just try to do my best in my job. But anyway, I kept on giving Dennis questions, and then these 9 months passed that I had been working with the temple ceremony. I had to take trips to Provo as well, with the translation. After I got it finished, I had to take the translation to the Provo Temple to coordinate it with the film, because in Salt Lake Temple they don't have the film.
They have actors there, don't they?
Right, they have live actors. So I had to take it to Provo Temple. One interesting point about that temple ceremony thing, too, is that every time I left the fifth floor Talmage room or wherever, sometimes I was also using the fourth floor, which is the general authorities floor.
Mm-hmm.
The whole floor is for the general authorities, but they only use it Thursdays. So the other days of the week, if the Talmage room, it being a small room, if there were other translators there and you wanted to concentrate and be alone, you could go to the fourth floor, to the general authorities floor, and use one of the rooms there and translate and think and meditate on the things there. So I had an opportunity to wander around that temple and to find that there are even locker rooms for the general authorities where they lock their clothes and even being in the upper floors of the temple, which was an amazing thing to me. There I had a chance also to ask questions from the channel authorities. We usually were, suggestion to us was that we should ask the questions only on Thursdays when they come to the meeting, and that we should put them in writing, and that they will try to answer them in writing as well. But so I had a lot of questions about the ceremony and the meaning of a particular statement, or many, many different statements. What was the hidden meaning behind? Many of the, if you have, you more than likely, Jim, have read the Sackett's book and read
yes,
the temple ceremony.
I'm quite familiar with it.
And you find it that it is quite mystic, the whole ceremony. And in order to get the full meaning and finish, I wanted to know what the hidden meaning was. What was the mystery mm-hmm. of that, because you can't hide the meaning in Finnish unless you know what the hidden meaning is.
That's
in
right.
English.
Yes, correct.
So I wanted to do absolutely correct job with that. I felt that a great responsibility to God as well as to the Mormon people, that they would not learn any different than what they were supposed to. And so I asked pointed questions, and I have had an opportunity to ask questions from Joseph Fielding Smith, from Harold B. Lee, as a prophet while I was translating. Then I have also had an opportunity to ask questions from other channel authorities concerning statements in a temple ceremony. And the answers, as a rule, came back saying, translate as it is. There were no explanations.
No mm.
There are no answers. One of the Swedish translators had been involved with a temple ceremony translation in 1955, and he told me that you're beating your head against the wall. There is not going to be any answers. He said that he had asked the questions in 1955, and David O. McKay had said, why should you understand it any better in Swedish than we understand it in English?
Isn't that an interesting thing? My.
Yes. So, Finn's a stubborn Bible. So I really, you know, I thought, well, if this is the truth, of course the prophet can tell me. He can understand it. He can explain it. But and this Swedish translator told me that that David O. McKay had told that he didn't mm-hmm. understand it. So why should we and not to worry about it? So I did have a lot of problems that came to me during that time as a Mormon. That didn't really cause me to leave Mormonism, because, as I mentioned, I thought if Mormonism isn't true, then there is no God.
And this is an interesting phenomenon, because here you're having these doubts about this, about the existence of God, and yet you're drawing your husband along, and somehow, you get what's going through my mind, Ronnie? Here you're saying, okay, Dennis, you're doubting yourself, and you're saying, Dennis, hey, come over here. What do you think about this? What do you think about that? You see, there's an interesting process taking as I listen to you.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go ahead. I didn't mean to really interrupt you, but I want you just to kind of catch the thing that's hitting my mind as a quote, Gentile. Listen
yes.
to you. You see, now let's go ahead then to the final process in your experience as a Mormon, and then we'll move into Dennis's situation here in the next little
okay.
while.
All right. Well, I continued another 9 more years as a translator for the Mormon Church. I was working from 1965 through the 1979. Clear to the end of December 1979,
mm-hmm.
When that is the time when I resigned. But in the last several years, my doubts became, you know, stronger and stronger, but yet I still hadn't found anyone who could show me who God is.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I didn't know where to go to ask the questions. I had totally accepted and adapted in my mind the doctrine that all other churches are abomination, like Joseph Smith said. So I wasn't looking into other churches, and no one from those churches was looking for me.
Mm-hmm.
But unbeknownst to me, there had my aunt came to visit us here in the United States in 1973 with her friend, and her friend is a Christian. They came and they stayed 3 weeks with us, and then they went back to Finland. Last Christmas time, I sent this friend a Christmas card, and I had not been in contact with her for years. And I sent her a Christmas card, and I said, we have left a Mormon church, and we are born-again Christians now. We have been able to make that break, and that we want to serve the Lord with all our lives, with everything we are, with our mind, soul, and body, everything we are.
Uh-huh.
We want to serve the real God and real Jesus. And she called me from Finland January this year, and she said she had been praying ever since she came to see. She said she didn't know where Mormonism was wrong, but she was praying that the God, the true God, will reach out and put us where he wants us to be.
Isn't that marvelous?
Yes, and so I can really say that you Christians pray for the Mormons. Pick out the single out the Mormon friend, and you start praying for that Mormon friend, and God will work out miracles in their lives. But these questions from the Mormon temple ceremony went through the other books of Mormonism, to the books that average Mormons don't have access to or do not care to read. And little by little, I started to point out questions to Dennis from these books, the books of history. Dennis was the one that brought me the book, The Seer by Orson Pratt, and to read. He had not questioned it, but he wanted me to read it. And I read it, and, you know, I'll let him talk to you about that. But it took that many years. See, I had actually had questions and doubts almost from the very beginning, but I still went on full force endorsing Mormonism because I believed that it was my own inability or lack of knowledge of Mormonism and that caused me to doubt it, that if I only read all the books and if I knew the whole picture, then it would all fit in perfectly, and there would be no doubts anymore. But when I started to pick up the Bible and start comparing, finally God led me to His Word. God knew that I was honest in my heart. I wanted to know. I was praying, not necessarily to a Mormon God. I was praying when I was reading the Bible. I was praying, God, help me. God, help me to see. Help me to see how the Mormonism fits into your word. And he started to show me that it didn't.
My, what an experience. Ronnie, there are people listening to this program, have been listening now for quite a period of time, who have these same doubts that you have, and they don't know who to ask. I know, as surely as we're sitting in front of these microphones, there are people out there who have these nagging doubts that they've had, and they've buried them, they pushed them away, and they have indeed violated their own conscience. And it's a sad and dangerous thing to do. And I would encourage those of you that are listening to our broadcast now, and I would encourage you to, if you know others that have the same feeling, pass this word along. Call Saints Alive. Call our toll-free number, and it's 1-800-522-5333. Let us put you in touch with perhaps Dennis and Rowney. Let us put you in touch with people who have been in the same kind of shoes that these young people have been in. And if nothing else, if you just do nothing else but get God's Word, the Bible, you can use your missionary Bible, or any Bible you get your hands on, begin to read that. Just start with John in the New Testament. Begin to read that book. And believe it as God's Word, not messed up, not all fouled up with all kinds of strange translations, because it isn't. Read that book and begin to do as Rowney did, and ask the God of the Bible to begin to realize, to reveal to you His truth. You don't have to come to Saints Alive. You don't have to run to some, quote, as you think of them, as anti-Mormon group of people. But go to God Himself. The God of the Bible is a living and a real God. And He can answer your questions. He can meet your needs. He is the one that you can come to and say, okay, God, I'm confused. I messed up. I'm scared. God, do you really exist? You know, if you do, I want to know you. If you don't, then I'll just have to conclude that. But God, I challenge you to reveal yourself to me in a way that I will understand you rightly and correctly. Believe me, friends, God will do that. He is not a dead God. He is not a God who is silent. He's not a God who cannot hear us. And I encourage you to contact us, and we'll put you, if you need to talk to Dennis and Rowney, we'll put you directly in touch with them, and you can ask them these questions. You can go over these things. You can confirm and verify the very things that she's been speaking. We're interviewing today, as we have been for some time now, Dennis and Ronnie Higley from Vernal, Utah. And up to this point in time, from my standpoint, it's been an extremely interesting and exciting talk that we've had, Dennis and Ronnie. And we were talking about your reaching a point in your life as a Mormon, as a Temple Mormon, as a translator of the Temple ritual and many other works of the church, the priesthood materials, the Sunday school materials, into Finnish, that you had reached a point in your life to where enough doubts had come into your mind that you began to wonder, really, if the God of Mormonism was really there. And then in this room you told me about, the, I guess it's the fourth floor of the temple.
A fifth floor.
It was in the fifth floor, where you prayed this prayer to God, the God that you encountered in Mormonism, or the God you thought should be in Mormonism. You prayed in this solitary moment and said, God, somehow reveal yourself to me. And he was silent. He was silent. Ronnie, would you just pick up here now, and I want us to move right along, but go through the next series of stages in your life on this, let's call it a pilgrimage now, because you've decided that you've got to do something. You've got to find out. There's some answers that have got to be there, because the God you expected to answer didn't answer. And so I want you to just pick up right there. And what happened next?
My studies continued. This happened when I started to pray to the God of Mormonism, the God that I thought was my God, and who was silent. I prayed that. That started in 1970. But I continued 9 more years. I'm studying the Mormon history, studying the Mormon doctrine, and then when I realized there was gross contradictions, the problems were such a magnitude that I couldn't handle it anymore. I realized that there was the God of Mormonism was dead. There was no God there, and my only source to rely if there was God at all would have to go from the Bible, through the God of the Bible. And I started to study and read the Bible, and I was praying that, God, if you are there, then speak to me through this word.
Uh-huh.
And he did.
He did.
He did.
And so we're saying that there is a God who is really real, and that this God can really reveal himself to a person who will actually open his heart up and say, okay, God of the Bible, reveal yourself to me.
Yes.
Okay, now was there any another thing that began to then feed your life? You read the Bible. And where did you come to the place where you said, Jesus Christ, come into my life, or whatever you did?
It was after we started to study the Gospel of John together as a family. We started to study that, and from the Gospel of John, through the tape, Firefighters of Christ tape ministry, the study tapes for the Gospel of John, that's where it really started to speak to me that I needed to do something. I knew God was there. He had already answered. He already had spoken to me through his word. But now it was my turn to claim him as my God and commit my life to him and to invite him to be the Lord and master of my life and confess that I was a sinner and I had to repent from my wanderings into Mormonism, my temple rituals, my forsaking the God of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to do the repenting. I had to ask him to forgive me and to, from there on, take control of my life.
And did anything happen then in your life?
Yes. My life just totally changed. I received a tremendous freedom. God freed me from the bondage. It was just like the bonds were just totally ripped off for my mind, for my hands, for my everything, for my whole being. I was free. I was totally freed. And the tremendous joy came to my life. And even though we experienced a struggle as a family, because Dennis hadn't come, he had come to know that the Mormonism wasn't true, but he had not come to know the Lord yet. We had conflict and struggle as a family, but the Lord carried me through that because I still had him, and he was the joy of my life, and I knew that it was just a matter of time that he was going to speak to the rest of my family.
Oh, so in other words, we're saying here that Christianity, that really knowing Jesus, is not some kind of a euphoric trip where you go off and it's pie in the sky by and by, but you're still a real person. But you've got a real God now.
Yes.
Who's with you and who loves you, and you can speak to him.
Yes, and you don't have to speak through the any man, or you don't need any mediators between you and your God. You can speak to him everywhere and anywhere, and he's right there with you. It's not like what Brigham Young said, that God only knows what's happening like any other ruler through the messengers that he sends. You know, this the God of the Bible is God. He is everywhere, and he lives in me now. He is Lord of my life.
So the God of the temple ritual that you mock, the God whose periphery is everywhere and whose center is nowhere, who sits on the top of a topless throne, et cetera, who is big enough to fill the entire universe and yet live in your heart, that God you actually mocked in the temple ritual was now, was that the God that suddenly became real to you?
Yes.
So that was a different, totally different God than you knew as a Mormon.
Right.
Okay, now you're, of course, at this point in time, you're still a Mormon. Dennis, here you are. Your wife is kind of charging along here, becoming an apostate really fast, and at some point in time, she's beginning to influence you. Now, what were the steps? Because you must have noticed, Dennis, that something was going on in her life.
Well, after she had, you know, exposed a lot of these things to me and brought them to light to me, the first thing she did was take her garments off. She said she wouldn't wear them anymore. And that was appalling to me, as we had been told we had to wear them 24 hours a day, every day of our life. And these things started to come out, and I rejected them. I did not want to let go of Mormonism, because I had been raised in it, and I believed in it, and that's where my whole life was. I'd been zealous in Mormonism. I'd done everything that I had been asked to do. I was a faithful member, and I was, like every faithful, active member, I was working my way to heaven, to Godhood, by living all these laws and commandments that the Mormon Church teaches. But it came to a point that I had to either accept Mormonism for what it was, or what it is, and live with that, or reject it and find the true Jesus Christ. And that was a difficult decision for me to make, because in rejecting Mormonism, I knew I was going to have to lose my family, my brothers and sisters, mm-hmm. my parents. And that was a hard decision. But Jesus Christ gives us life, not Joseph Smith or anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the thing, that the conclusion I had to come to was that life is in Jesus Christ, regardless of my family, so I had to make that type of a sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Now, undoubtedly, Dennis, Ronnie was, she was talking to you. Did she dump any of this anti-Mormon material in your lap, or were you out rushing around looking for anti-Mormon material, or what was the first thing that sort of began to rock the boat, might I ask?
Okay, while I was serving on the High Council of the Mazer Stake in Vernal, as a high councilman, we were assigned to speak once a month in one of the wards in the stake. And for one particular month, the topic of celestial marriage was given, and the book The Seer by Orson Pratt was given as resource material. So being a good zealous Mormon as I was, and not having read that book, I acquired it, took the resource material out of it that I wanted to use for that particular talk that I was to give, and gave the book to Rowney, and she read it, and she pointed out a lot of inconsistencies and ridiculous doctrine that I'd never heard about. And we put that aside and just kind of let it lay for the time being, but that was actually the beginning of my undoing in the Mormon Church while I was still serving on the High Council. Well, sometime after that, she got a hold of a copy of The Changing World of Mormonism by the Tanners from a very close friend of ours. And after she read that, She said there's a lot of things in there. It's a good book to read, and I didn't want to read it, and I didn't. And so she went to Salt Lake, visited the Tanners, and came home with about $150 worth of books and material from the Tanners, Shadow of Reality, which is the source book for Changing World of Mormonism, and plus a lot of other information, books that the Tanners have written. And so she started reading these during the day while I was at work and have me read excerpts from them at night when I got home. And I just got to the point that I was throwing the book back at her and saying that I did not want to read any more of that. But she didn't give up on me, thank goodness. And I accused Tanners of taking things out of context because they were quoting a lot of the books that we had and also the Journal of Discourses, which we didn't have. So I agreed to Rowney that I would go down and buy the Journal of Discourses and we would check all the references that the Tanners were quoting. So I went down and bought them and came home, and one evening we stacked all our books on the dining room table. History of the Church, Comprehensive History of the Church, Journal of Discourses, and everything else, and we started checking the Tanners. Rowney would read out of Shadow of Reality, and she'd give me the reference, and I'd look it up in Journal of Discourses or whatever book that they were quoting from, and they were right. There wasn't a word out of context. And I'd say, okay, next one. You know, I was doing this very systematically, very diplomatically, because I was going to prove the Tanners wrong. And just by quoting out of the original sources. But by about midnight, I couldn't find anything wrong with what the Tanners had quoted. Everything was done very, very carefully, and all their sources and quotes were absolutely correct. So at this point, I became more or less frustrated. I knew that I had to accept Mormonism for what it was and live with it, or reject it and find something else.
Okay, so you had come to a crossroads in your life, Dennis.
Yes, I had. And I finally decided that I had to make a decision. And now from the documentation that I had read, I knew that the leaders in Salt Lake that I had been following all the years of my life hadn't been telling me the truth. I had been lied to. I had been deceived. And this upset me so very bad. I was angry. I was upset. I was frustrated. But most of all, I was angry. I was angry at myself because I had been the subject of what felt like to be a practical joke. I'd been made a fool of. I had been led astray, and I had been deceived. And I didn't like that. And so At that point, I didn't want to have anything to do with organized religion. I didn't want to have anything to do with religion at all. I went and did things on Sunday that I had never done on Sunday ever in my life before, because I wasn't going to church anymore. I'd go out and drive around. I'd do a lot of photography. I'd take a lot of pictures. I just did things that I wanted to on Sunday. And I'd come home in time for dinner around noon and lay around the rest of the afternoon. Well, we started into this tape study that Rowney's mentioned, and the more we studied the Bible, the more I came to realize that you had to have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And all the years that I had studied seminary, I had never heard that. And out of one of these tapes that on John that we were studying, I'd learned more in that hour and a half of tapes and I had in all 4 years of seminary that I'd taken during high school. It was just miraculous, the new information, the new food that I was receiving. It was just amazing to me. But we still weren't fellowshipping with any particular church, because Rowney and I had agreed that we would not be involved with any kind of an organized religion. So for about a year, we just had held Bible study with our girls at home every Sunday on a regular basis. And as the more we studied, the more we came to realize that you have to fellowship with other believers in Jesus Christ. And so we started visiting some of the other Christian churches there in Vernal. And we settled on the First Baptist Church, because one of the main reasons, because they did teach the Bible, but also they were the pastor there, Herb Stoneman, was taking a stand with Saints Alive and with ex-Mormons. He was accepting Mormons into his congregation. He was supporting him, supporting them, and he was reaching out to the Mormons in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we settled on that particular church.
Right. Now becomes, we're suddenly into a new phase, aren't we? You've obviously through the tapes, you have made a personal commitment to Jesus Christ in your own life.
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely.
And then did this sort of thing that happened around you happen to you? Did you get this joy and this peace in your heart?
Well, as I've related it to people before in the seminars that we hold, that it was like coming out of a tunnel into bright daylight. It was, I had been in darkness, and the further I studied in the Bible, the more I studied, the brighter the light got. The freedom, that was the thing. When I accepted Jesus Christ, it was the freedom I felt. I was no longer bound by the laws and ordinances of the gospel, quote-unquote.
Yes.
The Mormon terminology.
Okay.
And it's such a free feeling to know Jesus Christ, to know that you're free from the law, that Jesus is the way.
He's the answer.
He's
Hallelujah.
The answer.
Tremendous.
So, and with the encouragement of our pastor, he asked us to teach a class on Sunday evenings in the First Baptist Church on witnessing to Mormons and Mormonism. And we kind of, people ask us, well, what do you do now? And we kind of jokingly say that we teach Mormon doctrine in a Baptist church.
And,
but that's what we do. And because of this newfound joy that we have, now being zealous Christians, of course, the first thing we want to do is go out and tell all our family and friends, and which at that time, not having a good basis in Christianity, was probably the wrong thing to do because we were absolutely rejected. I've been disowned by my family, more or less. They don't want to know anything about Christianity or Jesus Christ. But knowing that Mormons are a lost people, we have started a ministry to Mormons through the Christians. We are teaching Christians now. We hold seminars on a regular basis wherever we're invited to, in equipping the Christian bodies with an understanding of Mormonism and Mormon doctrine, Mormon terminology.
Mm-hmm.
So when the Christian goes out to witness to Mormons, he knows where the Mormon is coming from and what the Mormon is talking about. When the Mormon says, yes, I believe in Jesus Christ, the Christian knows that the Mormon believes in a different Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mormon says, yes, I believe in God.
Yes.
That the Christian knows that the Mormon is believing in a different God. And so it's the whole overview of Mormonism is what we try to teach to the Christians, so the Christian knows that the Mormons are a lost people and where they're coming from and that they are going to hell because they're believing in a false God and a false Jesus Christ.
Okay, and so now we're down here to the bottom line, aren't we? And as I've known for some time, as you've shared with me, and as I began to watch you two across the country as you share, the one thing I am seeing... Now, you're not going out in anger, obviously. You're going out in love.
Absolutely.
And
and
Ronnie's nodding her head. And so you're not people out there beating the bushes and trying to whack the Mormons over the head with a Jesus stick, are you?
No, we have no vendetta towards the Mormons at all. We love the Mormons. I still have family. All of my family for four generations have been Mormons. All my brothers and sisters, all my relatives are still Mormons.
I always ask the question to the person who makes this kind of statement, how can a person ever having been a Mormon and loved the Mormon and lived with these people and understood their culture, how could you ever hate the Mormon people? There's no way.
No.
No. And now, here you are, and God has called you to a ministry, a full-time ministry. And this is where I want our radio audience to really tune in your ears right now. Because I'm sitting across a little table from two beautiful people who have broken hearts for the Mormon people, who are not out on a vendetta, and who God has shown to me and to other people that He is bearing fruit in their lives, and He has stamped their ministry with the stamp of His Shekinah glory. That He is, like Ronnie in this little town in southern Utah, where He put you into a crowd of hostile Mormons, and yet, because of the love of Jesus Christ, these very same people wanted you to show the film again. And out of that, one of the elders, priesthood, quorum men, came to Jesus Christ, and God gave you a gift of utterance where you could actually answer His questions beyond your own understanding and wisdom. A miracle-working God. Now, people that are out there in our radio audience, you listen to me. These young people, they need to get out in a full-time ministry. They need your support. And I challenge you. I challenge you. Be a part of the greatest vision I've ever seen as a member of Saints Alive and as a member of the body of Christ working among Mormon people. You meet this challenge. Get in touch with Saints Alive. Ask us how you can be involved in the support of Dennis and Ronnie Higley, who have lost their, they've left their business. God has shown them that they're not to be in a secular business anymore. He's put them into a place where they have got to trust Him totally for their sustenance and the next house payment, for their food and groceries. And so, you contact Saints Alive and ask us how you can get involved. We want to see this ministry going. We believe that these young people have been called of God to go out and to share the unsearchable riches with Jesus, of Jesus Christ with the Mormon people. And He has proved it to me. He's proved it to people in Brigham City, in Ogden, in Salt Lake City, in Wellington, and other cities throughout Utah. Is demonstrating, I think, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the mark of the calling of God is on these lives. And so I challenge you, Saints Alive challenges you, get in touch with us over the watch line and ask us how you can contact us or write us at our box number. And so, Dennis and Ronnie, thank you for your time. God bless you. As you go into this full-time ministry, I believe God has put His stamp of approval on your work, and I will do everything I can to see this fulfilled as a human being. Lord bless you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. Praise the Lord.